Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest joining us from Melbourne, Australia, is Patricia Dennis. She is author of Health to Happiness, a Concentration Camp Childhood to a... Health to Happiness, a Concentration Camp Childhood to a Life of Abundance. It's a memoir of her undying spirit, Living on Borrowed Time Will Sharpen Your Appreciation for Life. This book is a true story full of passion, hope, and inspiration. An international author, Patricia Dennis, shares what it was like to spend 3.5 years growing up in a Japanese concentration camp in the Philippines. Having miraculously survived, she went on to achieve great personal and business triumphs. Patricia's amazing story provides beautiful lessons on how trust, faith, and self-belief can take you from hell to happiness. For more information, you can visit her website, which is helltohappiness.com, and I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Patricia to the show. Good day, Tricia. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, good morning, Robert. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, this was probably one of the most moving memoirs I have read, and I've read many. So I'm so delighted to have you here to share with us your wonderful life experience.
It's my great privilege. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. So, well, let's first of all start with, you know, why is it that you decided to write your memoir? Because, you know, recalling your early years, it must have been a real painful experience to at least do that. So what was the inspiration for you to even write the memoir?
Well, basically, my family, asked me, and in particular my youngest daughter, she seemed very keen to have the memoir or the memories of my whole life so that when I sort of passed on, she'd still have something tangible that, you know, would she felt hold my energy and keep close to her. So and family and friends all said, oh, you've had a very unusual life, an exciting life. Why don't you write it? So, later on in life, when I was 80, I did.
Boy, you know, I mean, it's just wonderful. Now, and I read that you weren't really computer proficient, so you did it initially all by hand, and that's... must have been quite a task to do.
It was, you know, because I had bought a computer, but I was just learning it, and I was so busy thinking, where's ABC, where's delete, where's and I just wasn't thinking about what I was writing at all. I was just writing, you know, thinking about what my fingers were doing. So I thought, this is not going to work. So I virtually bought, you know, a great big ream of paper and 100 black biro pens, and away I went. It took me a year to do it. I had to really unravel my life and, you know, go through the whole thing and go through all the emotions and so on before I could really write it. Otherwise, it would have just been a factual account, you know.
Yeah.
It was sort of coming through my heart, and it was easier to get the words down on paper because they seemed to come straight from your heart, right along your hand, and out on the page, you know.
Yes, you know, and that writing from the heart really comes through strongly when you read it. I mean, so and I think that is what people will most connect with, you know, when they read it, is that heartfelt, you know, emotion that you write about. So that was great. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about, I mean, you have, first of all, you know, at, I believe you're 82 now, you have had quite a storied life, you know, quite a bit of just all kinds of things going on. So we're going to kind of spend a little bit of time on each of those, you know, so that the listeners will get an idea of who you are. But let's first start up, you know, because part of the book talks about, you know, starting in that childhood concentration camp experience. So if you wouldn't mind, would you share with the listeners a little bit about that? Because I'm not sure many realize, you know, the Japanese, Philippine concentration camp kind of connection.
Well, that's a very good question, because I've found that myself, that when you talk about concentration camp, people generally think of Germany,
mm-hmm.
Poland, somewhere in Europe. And the theater of war in the Pacific hasn't really had much airplay. I know it was 70 years ago, but all the same, it's not really remembered very much, and even in Australia it's not particularly remembered when we have the 70-year anniversary of victory in the Pacific on the 15th of August last year. It sort of came and went, and it was almost a non-event, and I sort of expected it to be celebrated, but it wasn't.
Wow.
not general way.
Yeah. So now when this happened, what was the year that this particular the Japanese invasion happened, and what were the years that you were in the camp?
In the camp. Well, we were rounded up in 1942, the very beginning, because war broke out just, you know, at the end of 1941, and we went off to, well, first of all, we happened to be there for a start because my father was working for the Shell Oil Company, and my mother had the two of us. My father kept saying, you must really take these children back to Australia to be safe down in Australia with your grandfather, with our grandfather,
mm-hmm.
my mother's father. And she was loath to do that the third time she agreed to it, because much earlier on in my life, when I was born in London, she was separated from my father for 13 months, because when they had me, I wasn't able to drink her milk. It was way too strong. So they spent 13 months trying to find something to keep me alive before I could travel from London to the Philippines, although my father did go back to work, because that's where he was working. And so they had this very early separation in their marriage, and I think she was quite loath to think that if she took us away to safety to Australia, that there was no telling how long the separation would be. However, she agreed to go, but we were packed up and we were really going. And the night before, that's when the Japanese came by surprise and bombed all the American planes,
mm-hmm.
The ground, which was a terrible surprise. And that's why it was so successful, because it was a surprise. And bombs went off all round, and we were sort of lying in bed, and my parents just, you know, grabbed us and took us into their room, and, you know, the ground was shaking, the sky was ablaze with, you know, exploding, it was like fireworks, you know, on and on and on, it never ended type of thing, and the ground was shaking. So they thought, we can't really stay. We'll be bombed next any time now. The house will go, and we'll go with it. So my father and mother decided that it would be a good idea to get to ring friends in the country, which they did do, and then we were off there early in the morning, but when my mother went downstairs to get the servants, because, you know, in the East like that, you do have a chauffeur, you do have a cook and a houseboy, you know, and
mm-hmm.
well, they'd all fled. They'd fled overnight because of all the bombing, and there was nobody left at all. So, you know, my father packed the car, and then we set off to friends in the country where we thought we would be safe for a while, you know, out of this terrible bombing. But we were only safe for a short time because the Japanese started, you know, combing the countryside, and their main method of doing away with you is to cut your throat. And we just felt that we probably wouldn't be very safe, even we were in our isolation. But that didn't prove to be much good at all. You know, we were, nobody would have known if we'd have been killed. Nobody.
Right.
We decided to perhaps, you know, gather together in groups and come back into the city area, and where we might be safe. But, you know, lots of expats up there. You've got all kinds of people, you know, all nationalities. And if they're, you know, German, they belong to a German club. Or if they're British, they belong to the British club, or polo club, or the Army and Navy club. There were endless clubs you could belong to, you know, for your social life. And we joined up with the British club, and that was, you know, fine for a short time.
Yeah.
Short time.
Now, and you were age 7, is that correct, when this all happened?
Yes, I was. It was just a little bit over.
My goodness. And you know, in the book you go through some, you know, the description of just the really poor treatment and I mean the horrendous conditions, and I really don't want to focus much on that, except that there is one thing on the cover of your book. You have a picture that you created in pastel, you know, and it's a scene of an experience from the concentration camp. So I would, if you wouldn't mind, I would love if you would share with the listeners what that experience was, and why is it that you chose that image to be the cover of the book?
Well, I actually did it for a competition to start off with, and where there was an art exhibition, and they wanted everyone to paint under one title, and the title was Forbidden Fruit. And this image came back to me, and I did this illustration of the guards sitting there eating bananas in front of a great pile of tropical fruit, and the children hanging off the barbed wire fence because we couldn't get anything, and they weren't allowed to, and they were pretty strict, and they didn't ever give us anything. So we would just hang there, and we're just scrags, really, terribly skinny and so on, in the beside their compound, which was in the camp itself. And I thought, I was so busy running a B&B at the time that I didn't quite finish it, so I didn't send it down for the competition. So I still had it in my big art room. And when I wrote the book, I asked the publishers, now, do you think this is a suitable image? And they said, yes, we'd like to use it. So that's how that came to be. And then I finished it, of course, and submitted it, and that was the cover. But, you know, whether that just gives the idea that the whole book is about a concentration camp. Well, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
There's four chapters in it out of 24 that cover that in detail.
Yeah, but, you know, and I understand, you know, that, you know, the idea of, you know, I mean, your book is so much more than that experience. But, you know, to me, the image, in addition to the idea of the concentration camp, but it's also the idea of having something, you know, reaching for something that is kind of just beyond the fence, just, you know, that's just beyond the grasp, you know, that you long for, you know, and it seems that looking at some of the course of your life, that you've really had that motivation each and every time.
Well, that's quite true.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk about is that, you know, with the first of all, you know, so many people talk about having challenging childhood experiences, and this one tops them all, you know, as far as from people I've spoken with. But, you know, I think, you know, your book, the whole idea of your book is that despite those particular circumstances, that you've been able to build a life of happiness and been able to pursue, you know, what it is that you want, despite that. One of the things that you have, when I think about the impact, you know, the scars, the emotional and physical ones, because you also had a very challenging physical existence in that situation, that when one of those, first of all, do those continue to pop up in your life, you know, even to this day? And if they do, either the emotional and or physical, how do you... how does it impact you? How do you react to those, you know, images or feelings that resurface even to this day?
Are you talking about how I went about dealing with the emotion of unraveling my life?
Yeah, there's the emotion, and then also, you know, I also read in the book that, you know, you had you and your sister had you know, issues, physical issues with the lungs that kind of showed up later in life, you know, and those kinds of things, you know, from the, you know, the fact that you, you know, were on meager rations, you know, for
yes,
your stay there.
Yes, well, as you know, we had doctors and nurses who were actually interned with us, but, of course, we didn't have any medicine after the first year. So we did have epidemic upon epidemic of, you know, diphtheria, just everything you could imagine, fever, scarlet fever, dengue fever, chicken pox, smallpox, everything. And, of course, we were, you know, incarcerated in the big lecture rooms because the camp was the ideal place where you could incarcerate up to 7,000 people. Mainly it was less than that. That was during an overflow period. But we were in lecture rooms in the Santo Tomas University. That's where the sleeping quarters were. So you were in canvas stretcher beds with mosquito nets, and there would just be a sea of mosquito nets, and cheek by jowl, smack bang together were these canvas stretcher beds. So the single one. So you can see how an epidemic would
thrive. Mm-hmm.
The rage. And it's very, very contagious. And my sister did actually get the measles so badly. She was on death's door virtually. And at that point, she contracted, we think it must have been at that point, the TB in the lung. and she ended up with a scar of TB on her lung, and myself as well. So that was sort of discovered later on after we came to Australia and had chest x-rays and all that kind of thing. But, so it was essential to, if you could, to have a shanty. And shanty town spread up and sprang up all the way around these big main buildings of the university, which were actually housing us. And we weren't actually allowed to sleep in them because it was curfew. But during the epidemics, we were allowed to sleep in them because that, you know, just helped this lessen the spread of it or the intensity of an epidemic. And, of course, there are plenty of bed bugs and all that kind of thing that you get in tropical congested living.
Yeah.
So we were very lucky to have this shanty because otherwise all you would have would be this stretcher and really nowhere to go, except they did make everybody in the camp responsible to do something. It was virtually run by the internees. So you had the men, you know, doing the cleaning. You had the men doing cooking in the great rice vats, all needed to be cooked and cleaned afterwards. And, you know, people stood in line for hours and hours to just get the most meagre of rations. And we became very weak at the end of it, after 3.5 years. People who usually were expected to do four-hour shifts either, you know, in whatever capacity, could really only do about two hours, and then you had to lie down. In the end, we spent a lot of time lying down because we were too weak to do much else.
Yeah, boy. Now, one of the things that I read too is that you've always talked to your angels. You know, and so was that critical? I mean, when you were in the concentration camp situation, did you still do that there? And what was your feeling about, you know, to your angels? Well, you know, why me? Why here? Why now?
Well, I did. I had a very great belief in them, and I still do, and I really think, you know, this sort of helps you get through absolutely everything, because you're never really alone. When you are alone, you're never really alone. So you don't feel despondent or deserted or anything like that. You just feel that there's this invisible love force around you that you can sort of tap into and talk to and get a great feeling of being supported in a spiritual way, a completely non-denominational,
mm-hmm.
you know, not a denominational way, but in a sort of universal spiritual way. There's a great love force out there that you call, you know, I call upon all the time, and I find it's marvelous because
yeah.
I don't know how I'd get on without it. We didn't have schooling in the camp, but what we did have was a Sunday school session each Sunday. So I was, you know, very interested in what was talked about there and, you know, learnt about Jesus and the angels then. And I put them to the test one time and said that I was always sick and that I was always in the children's hospital with reoccurring bacillary dysentery. And would they please, you know, let me come to heaven, because I felt I was a terrible worry to my parents. And, well, absolutely nothing happened. I got better. So I thought, okay, well, I won't do that again. I can't be needed up there. So I just, you know, see what happens with life down here. And I must say that because we actually survived the camp, you know, miraculously, quite miraculously, and I'll go through that in a second, this, you know, even further, you know, proved as a wonderful basis to believe in a power much more greater and loving than than the human life, you know?
Exactly. Well, you know, and one of the things that I was amazed at, you know, when you talk about miraculously, you know, being liberated from there, but it seemed that you had several miraculous encounters. I mean, that you were really kind of, you know, you escaped death really kind of several times, you know, throughout that whole process.
Well, that's right. We did, for a start, when we left our house that morning after the bombing had started at night, and our house actually was bombed to the ground with nothing left, because my father paid it a visit before we were interned, a couple of days later, and he found everything was gone except just a great big cast iron bath was sort of tipped on its side and blackened. Apart from that, there was nothing, and then he found just on the edges of all the smouldering debris, he found his passport, you know, which was of course singed and charred, and also his civil engineer and marine engineer certificates. So he was both a civil engineer and a marine engineer. So, and they of course were charred as well. But we've got those today, which is, you know, really miraculous how they came and survived. I suppose they just went up in flames and then landed in a cooler spot, and you know, the flames went out.
Right. Well,
could have been us.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, with surviving, you know, those close encounters, you know, as a child, what was your view of yourself? You know, the fact that maybe there was a purpose for you to survive and to maybe do great things.
Yes, I was being confronted with the possibility of death really every day, because there was great surveillance and presence of Japanese guards and soldiers. You were never, you know, left in doubt as to why you were there and you mightn't be any time soon. You know, you had these great roll calls where if you didn't bow low enough every day, they'd sort of tap you on the shoulder with the bayonet and make you bow lower and make you do that for a long time until, you know, it was their pleasure that they'd let you stand up again. That's getting off the track, I know. And then, of course, when the Japanese, when the Americans came in, and ever so grateful for General Douglas MacArthur, because without him and his troops, we would never have survived. So I think, you know, really owe my life largely to our rescue and all the soldiers and the reality of all the soldiers that would have died in the battle trying to get us, because the Americans, we had a Japanese commandant, and he lived within the grounds, which is sort of illustrated in that front picture there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he had his sort of favourite entourage of soldiers and guards with him, and they lived actually in the camp. And one day on January the 25th or 6th of 1945, he came, one of these in the office orderlies, he came across a communique, and it was issued by the commandant that on the 4th of February 1945, which was, you know, just a week or more to come, that the entire number of people in the concentration camp would be beheaded.
Mm.
And that was happen on the 4th. So he was a double agent, and he got a message through to Douglas MacArthur, and he said he sent troops. We were second on his list for rescue, but he put us on the top, sent troops, but they were ambushed. Then he sent another lot of troops, and the Filipino guerrillas came through and brought those American soldiers and tanks through the paddy fields, so they weren't detected this time, and they came in at night on the eve of our beheading, which would have been the next day. And this, you know, was absolutely extraordinary. And I didn't find this out until years later, but we were always aware that we'd be either starved to death or we would be killed. Mm-hmm. And I would have dreams, actually, every night on whether we'd be sort of lined up and shot or how this would happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very real threat in our consciousness because of the presence of so many Japanese.
My goodness, my goodness. Well, gosh, Tricia, we're already halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break. And I do want to invite listeners that if you have any questions for Tricia, call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions you would like for me to pose to Tricia, feel free to type them in. And then when we return, Tricia, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to move on. We're going to move on to Australia and your liberation there, and then the next few chapters, okay? So, great. So, okay, great. We'll be right back after this very brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest joining us from Melbourne is Patricia Dennis, and we're talking about her book, Hell to Happiness: A Concentration Camp Childhood to a Life of Abundance. Again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is helltohappiness.com. And again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Patricia. Tricia?
Hello.
Okay. We have one of our listeners. By the way, I do want to say hello to Chris and Corrine in the chat room, and thanks for joining us. Corrine had a question, and let me go ahead and ask that right now before we go jump into what I had prepared. And it was, I wonder how long did it take for Patricia to forgive and let go of the fear? It certainly had to be difficult. Did you encounter any other prisoners over the years? And what happened to the others?
Well, being in Australia, we didn't actually. I think there was only one person that we did encounter years later. And it was wonderful, and it was just wonderful to speak to somebody else that had been in the concentration camp, because because most people hadn't had that experience, they could be interested in it, but then once they'd heard a little bit, that was enough. And we really never discussed it at home.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one of those things we'd all been through, my mother and father and my sister and myself. And it never came up as a
yeah.
point of discussion, you know. It was, and I think you'll find that is the case with lots of people, even soldiers who've been to war. They don't really talk about it unless it's to other soldiers perhaps who've been there, because otherwise there's nothing in common, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
An experience that you're relating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the fear, well, I wasn't really fearful, as I said, because I had this. It was terrifying, the whole experience and the anxiety of it all. But once we got to Australia, which, you know, was bridging yet another sort of big fear barrier, because we did get on a troop ship in the Philippines and we were repatriated to Australia, but we weren't safe even then until we got to Australia, because we were coming through enemy waters.
Mm.
Japanese torpedoes were sort of getting rid of a lot of the ships in the convoy coming this way, and we were lucky to get through and get through safely and arrive in Townsville. And that's when, you know, we kind of could release that sort of anxiety and that fear.
Yeah.
And being in a free country without a lot of rationing and food available and clothing, it was the most wonderful new experience. You know, it was like having Christmas.
And I read that, you know, just when you got there, that the Red Cross had clothing and shoes, and that you hadn't worn shoes in years. So that had to have been just a shock.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful, and I just couldn't help myself. I just chose a pair of black patent shoes. They were a little bit tight, but I had to have them.
That's good. Well, you know, when you got to Australia and you entered into the Sydney school system, one of the things that you indicated is that, you know, because of that experience that you had, kind of not up to speed, a bit behind with reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that you had adopted the motto of catching up and keeping up. So one of the things I wondered about that is that, you know, I can understand, you know, that it was good that you were able to be placed in an environment that allowed you to do that. And it seems to me that, you know, some of your experiences from that point on still had that sense of catch up and keep up. I mean, was I reading that correctly? That, I mean, because all of the jobs that you had afterwards, I mean, even the motherhood aspect seemed to have a lot of catch up and keep up.
Well, that's right, because, Robert, I've just had this extraordinary thing all my life that I feel as if I'm juggling, you know, juggling a lot of balls in the air, because I feel as if I've been living almost like three lives in one, if you know what I mean. It's gone off on different strains, but it's still been me doing it back to back all the time. Do you know, it sounds crazy, but with the motherhood, yes, that was a juggling act, because I then took up, you know, working after the two children were born. And then we came to the country after 3.5 years with my mother-in-law. And then we decided to have a second stream to the income, and we'd have potty calves, and we'd grow them out. So it meant going to the market and or having friends in the area, in the district of Beaconsfield where the farm was, and they would always ring and say, we've got these great calves, would you like to see them? And they usually were A-grade calves, so we'd buy them if they were heifers, and we were planning to do milking with them, you know, to get a milk contract. And it was very sort of basic living. We were pretty poor. But the thing was, it was always a challenge, and we were sort of hand-feeding them, bucket-feeding them, you know, with the Denkovite powdered milk and growing them out. And then I was still working, and we had a great life, really, because my husband was working at Nilex. He was working on three different shifts, you know, in the 24 hours. Each week it'd be a different shift. Some of the time he could look after the children, other times he couldn't. Then I had to get somebody in to look after them, to help me, because we were doing the cattle, and at the same time I was teaching in the city. We bought an old bomb of a car so that I could get to the railway station, you know, and on the train I'd stick on my false fingernails, and I was teaching the children deportment, teaching them all kinds of things, because I've been working in London, you know, with the modelling and overseas, and so I had quite a reservoir of things I could be teaching them. And then while I was there, I was invited to be a guest on the Hal Todd show, pardon me, and I was a guest, and he said, would you like to come in and talk to the ladies? So they said, what am I going to talk about? They said, oh, the camp, and so I did. Then I got a call back again 2 or 3 weeks later, could I come back in? Yes, what would I talk about this time? Oh, London, you know, all the work in London, and that sort of thing, film and television. And then what would I talk about next time, third time? Well, I would talk about ladies' issues and so on. And so they said, look, we'd like you to be on every week. So I then had a little spot in this daytime show to present to the ladies, you know, whatever it was I wanted to, a free range on any subject that I thought would interest them. And that was good, and sometimes I'd have twice a week I'd go in there, and still I'm teaching at the Model College now, and coming home to feed the potty calves.
I know. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and for the listeners, you know, what that encapsulated is after school, during, you were a teenage model, and then from there you basically get married, you go to Europe, and then you have, you know, experiences in Europe with the modeling aspect. Go back to Australia. You get this, you know, this teaching job at Bambi Smith Modeling College. During that, you're also invited to speak on that show, the Hal Todd show, and then you talk about women's issues, and then you have the farm. I mean, and the motherhood. You know, so I mean, when you said you have like several lifetimes in one, I would say at least a half a dozen. You know, and it seemed like so many of them were going. I mean, I was getting tired just reading about what it was that you had to do. But anyway, so that means, you know, and that is, you know, that. That is, you know, quite a something. Now with the farming, I'm curious with that. How did that, you know, come about? Was that something that you and your husband at the time had really entertained the idea of? Was that something that you, was that in your radar to actually have that as a life experience of yours, or how did that all come about?
Well, the short answer was no.
Okay.
Because when I first met him, he was on the farm. And I had said to him explicitly, don't ask me to marry you if you want me to live on the farm. I said, I absolutely know nothing about one. I've never been on one, and I couldn't think of it. You know, I couldn't really dream of it. It's just not in my vision because, you know, we'd had 3.5 years of great hardship, and I always thought it would be, you know, that coming back at me again. So I didn't really want it. Anyway, he did ask me to marry him, and he did say he'd get a job, and he did get a job in the city selling encyclopedias. But it wasn't very long after that that his mother made a grand suggestion. Why not ask Tricia to marry you and take her away on this skiing holiday with your sister and your brother-in-law because they're going? Well, of course, that was it. That was it. I was off on another tangent, and I did marry him, and never dreaming that I would end up on the farm. But after this sort of high life in London and overseas and so on, and I became pregnant, you know, even had wonderful offers from J. Arthur Rank and the photographers that I was working for in Amsterdam to continue and give me contracts, I couldn't really take any of them. So we came home, had the baby, soon had another baby, lived with mother-in-law, which was pretty trying.
They always are. They always are.
I wasn't her favorite person after all.
Oh, goodness.
Then we used to holiday up here at Grandpa's at Christmas time. And you know, after 3.5 years, I sort of thought it wasn't such a bad idea after all, because I'd be free of all that sort of being picked on. So That's why we started on the farm. And I must say, I just threw myself into it as usual, you know, and I felt it was the right thing to do at the time. And of course, it never... Brian was so delighted, actually, that I finally sort of come to love the country. And now, after all these great many years, I just love it and adore it. And I've ended up living here, back here. It's a complete full circle, I can tell you.
Yes. Now, I you know, one of the things that I was surprised at, and one of the things that many of my listeners would love to hear about, is that while on the farm, you had a crop circle experience, not only on yours, but on also like on adjacent farms. But on your particular farm, you had a crop circle experience. And you say that you mentioned, because a lot of people don't think those are real. So I would love for you to just tell us a little bit about that. To me, that's very, very interesting.
Yes, well, we did. It was on somebody else's property, but our cattle were being adjusted there.
Oh, okay.
Because we had a lot of cattle, and we kept buying pieces of land and, you know, sort of expanding that side of the business. We went up. They were cattle that we had joined with our bull, and they were springing, you know, just soon they would be having their calves, their first calf. So we drove up just to, you know, keep a check on them, and we did that on a regular basis to see how they were getting on. And this particular day we went, and it was absolutely extraordinary. There were these three big circles in this paddock, and it was a little bit hilly, and the cattle had actually eaten all of the feed from the inside of these circles, not from the outside. There was a distinct, you know, demarcation, perfect circle. I think there were a couple of big ones and then a small one, but they had just eaten the feed inside. So I just thought it was remarkable, because people tend to say, you know, make that they were a hoax, or somebody rushed there and beat them down with the broom, or whatever. You know, you hear all sorts of things, and I was absolutely thrilled that that this had happened, because I had heard about crop circles and I did believe they'd happened, Yeah, he was here. We had them on the land that we were adjusting, and the cattle loved it. They just loved that feed.
Yeah, see, to me, it's fascinating that they basically ate it inside the circle. That it was. Mm. I mean, to me, you know, it's when you logically think about, you know, what maybe transpired, it just makes you wonder exactly what was it, you know, that made that feed more attractive. You know, why eat that versus, you know, the outside? So anyway, I just think that it's very interesting. It makes you wonder. It's one of life's curiosities.
Well, it is really, because I went to a group one time who did believe in crop circles, and what they had done was to extract the fluid from the feed, and like it was purified, and they sold it to you in little bottles and with a little silver cap, and you could wear it round your neck. And they said that this, you know, was a great healing agent, and that they were trying it out on people with cancer, and they said it did work. So I don't know whether it does or not, but that's what they were, you know, mm-hmm. indicating. It had some special properties that it could radiate through the fluid.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. That's just by the by.
Very interesting. Well, guys, we're kind of getting down toward the end of the show. There's one area, though, I really want to take in, and it's basically about forgiveness. You know, like Corrine, when she mentioned about forgiving and letting go of the fear, there was one point in your book where you share about an experience during one of your art classes with your experience with a Japanese woman. And I would love for you, if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners, you know, what was your, from the time that you were released in the camp, or you were liberated from the camp, you know, what were your feelings, if you had any, about, you know, Japanese, you know, in particular, since you had your captors were Japanese. And then what was it that this woman in this art class, what was that interaction about, and how did that kind of lead to some forgiveness?
Yes, well, that was an extraordinary thing, really, because my attitude to the Japanese when we were released and, you know, from then on, I didn't actually have an opinion. I didn't like them, and I didn't hate them.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt completely numb
Yeah. Every
time I saw one or heard about them. It just went kind of numb.
Right.
So it was an odd feeling, and I never really got past it. So when I was at the age of about 50 or so, I was learning painting, and our art teacher, June Wood, she was very, very generous with her time, and during the school holidays she would arrange to take us into the art gallery in Melbourne, organise a guide and have a guided tour of whatever was showing of importance at that time. And the girls from the different classes would come, you know, we'd all come together. And what happened this particular day is we always had lunch afterwards at the gallery, and this Japanese girl, I suppose she would have been about 35-ish, she was one of the students. She actually came walking towards my table to sit down for lunch, and I sort of remember feeling, oh, please, please don't sit at my table, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. She came straight up, sat down, said, do you mind if I sit down with you? And I found myself saying, no, not at all. Please sit down. And then we got into conversation, and she was telling me that her husband was in Dubai working, that they were building a house in Japan on a very expensive small piece of land, and that she was in Melbourne while the son was being educated, but she was, you know, planning to go back and live in this house. And she said, look, Tricia, she said, and she knew nothing at all about my background,
mm-hmm.
and I had told her anything either, so she had no idea about my numbness.
Right.
And then she said, would you like to come and have a holiday with me? I'd love you to come to Japan and have a holiday. And I was absolutely blown away. And I'm going all fizzy even now, telling you. And I just felt this incredible numbness start to completely melt away. And it just sort of flowed all over me and melted. And from that moment on, I thought she was gorgeous. I thought she was wonderful. I can, and the whole Japanese race is fine. You don't have any sort of, you know, numbness anymore. It's just amazing. So she would have represented a generation that would have had nothing to do with war as well. So, you know, it was a wonderful experience, and I certainly didn't expect it. And I was always keen to stand up next to her at the easels, and we'd paint together. So it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, it sounds like that was. I mean, it just seems that was what really helped free your heart, you know, in many ways. And I just found that. Just very, you know, very touching. It's the kind of thing that, you know, if anyone out there is feeling that numbness, you know, that you know, to try and do something to be able to eliminate that. So, gosh, well, we're down toward the end of the show, Tricia. So, is there anything that you might want to add? What is it that you hope that the readers will take away from reading your book?
Well, I'm hoping that they'll be inspired to know that, you know, the obstacles, like the things that I've written on the back of the book, obstacles are just learning curves in achieving your dreams. And hope knows no bounds. And optimism is a key ingredient as you progress through life's journey. Take heart and move through every setback with confidence, and persistence wins through, and make every moment in your life count, and know you are never alone.
Well, those are wonderful gifts that people will get from reading your book. So, you know, Tricia, this has been such a delight. I want to thank you so very much for getting up early there in Melbourne and sharing this time with us.
It has been my greatest joy to do so, Robert, and thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. And I'll be sure to add your book to my recommended reading list. I'll be telling a lot of people about it. So.
Fantastic. Thank you for doing that.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest joining us from Melbourne has been Patricia Davis. We've been talking about her book, Hell to Happiness, A Concentration Camp Childhood to a Life of Abundance. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is helltohappiness.com. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.